We are going through these seven letters to the churches in Asia, and I would like to emphasize again that these are not local letters. They are not ad hoc letters written only for these particular congregations. If that were so, then the seven letters to the seven churches would simply be museum pieces. They would simply be of academic interest. These are letters for the universal church. And John's message to the seven churches in Asia is a message that applies to the church throughout the whole age of grace. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the churches of all time. And what John is really doing in these seven letters is this. He is saying, this is church history. This is what the work of Christ is going to be like from the first coming of Christ until the second and the last coming of Christ. Now that is the age of grace. Now this is what the church is going to be like throughout the age of grace. And generally speaking, the picture that is presented to us in these seven letters is a picture of decline from the original simplicity of Christ. Generally speaking, the story of the Christian church is a story about the loss of spiritual life, the loss of vitality from the Christian church in the age of grace, and the gradual drifting away of the church from the original simplicity and power of Christ. So that nowadays, you see, in the year of grace 1975, a vital church is an exception rather than the rule. Strictly speaking, every Christian church ought to be alive. But they're not. Living churches are the exception rather than the rule. And revival in the church is something that is the exception rather than the rule. And that is the picture that is presented in these seven letters. Some scholars think that the death of the church started very early on. I remember how Professor McEwen used to teach us in our church history lectures that towards the end of the first century, the death was into the Church of Christ. Now, there are several years that are sometimes called the silent years or the lost years, because we don't hear very much about the Christians during these years. And Professor McEwen used to say that the church that emerges at the end of these silent years is quite different from the church in the book of the Acts of the Apostles. For example, you see bishops developing. You see the beginnings of the episcopal sort of ministry that was to lead to all the errors of the medieval papacy, with the Pope claiming himself to be the successor of Peter and King of the kings of the earth and all that sort of thing. Now you begin to see this in 100 AD. As early as that, the church is beginning to die. Now, perhaps you think that's too strong language. Well, if you do, listen to these facts. That of these seven churches, the first and the seventh are cold. Ephesus had lost its first love. Now, if you lose love, you lose warmth, don't you? If the love goes out of a marriage, it becomes a dead thing. It becomes sterile. It becomes a cold marriage. The first church had gone cold because the temperature had dropped on her love for Jesus Christ. And the last church too had gone cool because Laodicea was the church that was neither hot nor cold. It was lukewarm. Now isn't that interesting? And if you don't accept that, have you noticed how Satan makes inroads into these churches? We were thinking of this last Sunday evening. In Ephesus, Satan was outside the church, the temple of Diana. In Smyrna, there was a synagogue of Satan inside the church. In Pergamum, Satan's throne was inside the church. And in Thyatira, one of the letters we read tonight, the deep things of Satan were being taught by a Jezebel who was in charge of the church. And later on we'll see that in the church at Philadelphia, there was also a synagogue of Satan. And so you see, you have a gradual penetration of the work of Jesus Christ by the enemy of Jesus Christ. First of all, he's outside the church, and then he's got a synagogue inside it, and then he's got a throne, and then he has a Jezebel teaching the deep things of Satan. Have I convinced you? Listen to this. Only 2 out of 7 churches are commended without reserve by Christ. 2 out of 7 are nearly repudiated by him. And 3 out of 7 are indifferent. They're middle-of-the-road churches. They are neither desperately for Christ, nor are they desperately against him. 3 out of 7. That's 5 churches out of 7 in an unsatisfactory condition. And what John is saying is this. This is church history. And what I want you to do as we go through these churches and compare them, setting one against the other, I want you to be asking the question that the disciples asked at the Last Supper, and I want you to say, Lord, is it I? Am I part of this death? Am I making a contribution of life to this fellowship? Or am I ministering to the death of the church? Lord, is it I? And what I'm trying to do is to set one church against another and compare the churches. We're doing them in pairs. Last week it was Smyrna against Pergamum. Smyrna, the drunken city, the city that was famed for its drunkards. Pergamum, the city that was famed for its parchment, the academic city, the university town with a library of 200,000 books, which was remarkable in those days. The drunken city against the academic city, and how it was in the drunken city that the Christians survived, because it was in Smyrna, the city of Smyrna, symbol of suffering. Myrrh is a symbol of suffering. That's why the kings brought myrrh to Jesus, because he was going to be a suffering king. And so in Smyrna, the drunken city, the aura, vulgar, rough, crude, primitive city, It was there that the church survived and earned Christ's great well done. But in Pergamum, neither for nor against, a middling church. What a story this is. And the question is, Lord, is it I? Are we like this, Christ? Are we part of your living onward march through history? Or has the death entered into us? That's the question. Lord, is it I? Now the churches tonight are Thyatira and Sardis. And to understand what had happened to the Christians in these two towns, Thyatira and Sardis, I think we need to understand a little bit about the background of these cities. Now the interesting thing is this. We'll start with Thyatira, whose bishop was at the enthronement of Dr. Coggan. The interesting thing is this, that Thyatira is the least important of these seven towns. It's the smallest town, and yet it gets the longest letter. And it gets the most mysterious letter, because it's about a Jezebel teaching the deep things of Satan inside the Christian church. Now, what's the clue to Thyatira? It's this. I quote, "Here were bakers, potters, tanners, weavers, wool workers, linen workers, makers of outer garments and dyers." You got the message? It was a commercial gold mine. You remember the story of how Paul came to Philippi and how the first convert in Europe was a lady called Lydia? Listen to these words. "Lydia, a seller of purple of the city of Thyatira." She was a grand businesswoman, and she came from a commercial gold mine. Now the problem was that all these businessmen banded themselves together into guilds, into clubs, and private societies. And very often, when a man came to Christ, he found himself torn between the claims of Jesus Christ and the claims of the private society. Now, this is something that every Christian who means business with Jesus Christ meets in his life. Let me ask some of you Christian men. Have you never felt yourself torn between the claims of the secular, worldly world and the absolute claims of Jesus Christ? Now, that was the tension in Thyatira, because some of these guilds there had pretty much the same power over men's lives as trade unions today. Now, some of the trade unions have tremendous power. I'm not condemning trade unionism, because it's done a powerful amount of good for working class men. But sometimes there is a power in trade unionism that overrules the freedom of men's consciences. And when a man stands up and says, "I cannot do this for the sake of my conscience," or "I cannot do this because it goes against my Christian principles. He is in a minority. And that's the battle. The secular world says, obey me. And the voice of Jesus says, follow me. Have you ever felt this tension in your life? I hope you have. It's a sign that you're a living Christian. You see, to be a Christian is to be like a fish swimming against the stream. It's only dead fish who float with the stream. Real Christians are against the stream. Jesus says, follow me. But the guilds and the clubs and the inn boys say, follow me. And that's the tension in Thyatira. Now, of course, there are two answers to this tension. There's the answer of Christ. Christ says, friendship with the world is enmity against God. Christ says, touch not the unclean thing. But there was somebody in Thyatira who had another answer, and her name was Jezebel, and she said, compromise. Do you know the story of Jezebel in the Old Testament and how she came down, the daughter of Ithbaal, king of Tyre and Sidon, a princess in her own right? She came down to marry the king of Israel, and when she came down, she brought with her her gods and the priests of her gods. And she tried to integrate the religion of Jehovah with the religion of Baal. That's why she quarreled with Elijah. Elijah wouldn't have it. Elijah washed his hands of the woman and said, no! The word God has no plural. Gods is not the plural of God, because God is no plural. There is only one God. And Jezebel said, elasticate yourself, Manny. Become more rubbery. Why don't you bend a little, Elijah? And it was because Elijah wouldn't bend that there was the clash with Jezebel. Would you say that we were a fellowship who had compromised with worldly standards? Do we need worldly fashions in order to stay alive and survive as a Christian church? Would you say that we were a fellowship who were trying to integrate Baal and Jehovah? Oh, there are churches that have so elasticated themselves that Baal and Jehovah sleep in the same bed. They're great bedfellows because there's no difference between them. Compromise. That was Thyatira, the deep things of Satan. I wonder if you've read C.S. Lewis's sermon called The Inner Ring. He says, in every society, and especially in the church, there are inner rings. Some of them are good, of course. Some of them are evil. And if you're not careful,
They'll suck you in. Compromise. Lord, is it I?
The second city is the city of Sardis. Sardis was a city that was built on a hill, and its cliffs were absolutely perpendicular. It was quite a phenomenon. The city was here, and the cliffs were perpendicular. And its people were proud and arrogant and overconfident, and they were convinced that Sardis could never be taken. But they hadn't noticed that there was a crack in the cliff that led to Sardis. And twice, Sardis fell. That's why Jesus says in chapter 3, verse 3b, "If you will not awake, I will come like a thief." You see? This had happened twice in the city's history. Men had got up the crack on the cliff and captured the town. "I will come like a thief, and you will not know at what hour I will come upon you." The second clue to Sardis' history is the fact that when this letter to Sardis was written, the whole town was facing decay because an earthquake had destroyed the city and a new town was being built. And so Jesus says to Sardis in verse 2a, "Awake and strengthen what remains and is on the point of death," because half the city was in ruins because of the earthquake and the other half was being rebuilt. "Awake and strengthen what remains and is on the point of death." The third clue to Sardis is the fact that the town smelt of sheep, because that's where the sheep market was. And wherever you went in Sardis, you had the pungent, fatty, greasy, unpleasant odor, the sort of smell you find in a sheep market, because it was from these sheep that the white wool came for the clothes. Jesus says to Sardis, verse 4a, "Yet you have still a few names in Sardis, people who have not soiled their garments." You see, it was a sheep market, and they made woolen clothes. "And they shall walk with me in white wool, for they are worthy. He who conquers shall be clad thus in white garments." There it is again, the sheep market. "And I will not blot his name out of the book of life. I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit is saying to the churches." And written all over the town, verse 1, the end of the verse, "I know your works. You have the name of being alive, and you are dead." Here was a church, and from the outside, there was nothing you could condemn. It was a good-going church. The Christians in it were sound. But it was dead. You know, one of the greatest enemies of Jesus Christ in the church today a far greater menace to Christ than atheism or agnosticism it's the menace of dead orthodoxy people who are sound but dead people who are sound but spiritless people who believe the right things and have a name that they are alive. And they're dead. The sin of Thyatira was the sin of compromise. The sin of Sardis was the sin of coldness. Sound, but dead. Believing all the right things, but no life. One of the most pathetic women in all stories is Miss Havisham in Great Expectations. Do you know that scene when Estella is visiting her and she sits there, she's been rejected on her marriage day, and she sits there surrounded with what was to have been the wedding feast. The curtains are falling to pieces in ribbons. The mice are scurrying all over the place. And the centerpiece is a ghastly wedding cake that has been eaten by the beasties. And she sits there in all her isolation and her pride. Cold. And pathetic. Oh, I tell you, it's great to believe the right things, but you must believe the right things and have the Spirit of Christ in you. Jesus said, take heed what ye hear. That means it's important to listen to the right things. Jesus also said, take heed how ye hear. Truth without spirit is cold and dead, but truth with spirit. The sin of Thyatira, the sin of compromise. Lord, is it I? Is this what we are like as a church? The sin of Sardis. Cold orthodoxy. Lord, is it I? Is this what we are like? Amen. May God bless the preaching of His word. To His name be the honor and glory.